Mike Stanton, Rocky Marciano died almost 50 years ago in 1969, and boxing is far less popular now than it was in mid-20th century America. So what attracted you to the idea of telling Rocky Marciano's story?
I looked at Marciano's story really as an American story that transcends boxing, and it's an inspiring story with a lot of interesting characters. It really covers a rich period in American history that fascinated me. Rocky grew up an Italian immigrant son in Brockton, Massachusetts. He was born in the anti-immigrant 1920s, and in fact, Sacco and Vanzetti were arrested off the Brockton streetcar not far from his grandfather's house, executed when he was a little boy. He came of age during the Great Depression. He went to war, World War II, in the 40s, and then fought his way to the top of the boxing ranks in the post-war America, when America was really changing, when the mafia controlled the sport. It was a really rugged, vicious sport, hence my subtitle, Rocky Marciano's Fight for Perfection in a Crooked World.
And let me stop you there. And as you say, he did create an amazing record of perfection in professional sports, perhaps an unparalleled accomplishment. He had a career record of 49 wins and no losses. That seems really extraordinary, given how boxing greats like Muhammad Ali, known as the greatest, even he had a couple of losses. Mm-hmm. How was Marciano able to do this?
Well, luck and tenacity. And he also knew when to walk away from the ring and not overstay his welcome. But that's a remarkable part of the story, is that he was a guy, you know, his trainer said, you know, I got a guy who's stoop-shouldered, balding, has two left feet. He don't look so good in style, but his opponents don't look so good on their backs on the canvas. And he could, he delivered a punch that was probably the most powerful punch in heavyweight history. His trainer nicknamed it the Susie Q. And one opponent said, every time he hit you, you saw a flash of light. And he also had an incredible ability to take punishment, to take whatever was dished out. And the few times that he was knocked out in his career, knocked down, he got up and came back to win against, seemingly insurmountable odds.
As you say, organized crime had a lot of influence in boxing when Marciano was active. How was he affected by that?
Rocky knew he had to deal with the organized crime figures if he wanted to get a shot at the title. His manager, Al Weill, was one of the most well-connected managers in boxing, and he was a puppet of the mob. And he was controlled and closely associated with Frankie Carbo, who was a notorious national mob figure, a hitman for Murder, Inc., and known as the underworld commissioner of boxing. And so Rocky basically was frustrated by this, but he also understood that his path to the title lay through Al Weill and doing what they told him, and, you know, that got him the shot at the title.
I've read your book, and I've been impressed by it. Not only is it a really fascinating story, you unearthed some new information. For example, how Marciano, before his professional career began, he was confined at a military facility after service during World War II, and he had injured his boxing hand, and he was operated on by a Japanese-American who I believe was confined as part of what happened with the Japanese-Americans in the U.S. during World War II. And had that not happened, Marciano would not have been able to pursue his boxing career. Tell us about your research process and how you made some of these fresh discoveries about a guy who had been one of the best-known athletes of the mid-20th century.
Yes, thanks for asking that question, because that really does speak to what really appealed to me about this story, you know, the immigrant struggle. And, you know, we just had a Supreme Court ruling the other day on the President Trump's travel ban. And one of the cases that was cited in that ruling both ways was the Korematsu decision that during World War II that allowed the U.S. government to intern Japanese Americans in camps. And Rocky, just starting with the end of that story, was fighting in Fort Lewis, Washington, in the Pacific Northwest after the war in 1946. And he was still very clumsy, and he injured his knuckle severely, hitting an opponent on the top of his head in an AAU fight in Portland, Oregon. And it might have been a career-ending injury if not for a Japanese-American doctor, Thomas Takeda, who performed an experimental operation that wound up saving his career. And Tom Takeda had been in medical school in the Midwest and when the war broke out, and he was spared, but his family was sent to internment camps. And he faced prejudice in medical school as a Japanese-American. But he overcame that, and still the U.S. government would not send him to serve overseas in the Army because they didn't trust him because he was Japanese-American. So he was at this base and in the spot to save Rocky's career. To go further back, you know, one of the things about the 1950s, kind of that golden age of sports, is Rocky was this kind of all-American hero. Kind of, you know, people said he embodied the American values in the fight against communism. He punched, like, the atomic bomb. And the shorthand story that the public knew about his war service was he served in World War II and he helped ferry supplies to Normandy during the D-Day invasion. And what people didn't realize is that he didn't actually make that trek because he was in a army stockade. He was court-martialed. He and another GI assaulted and robbed two British civilians after they went AWOL from their base shortly before the D-Day invasion. And Rocky was sentenced to 7 years of hard labor. And that was later reduced, and he later stayed in the Army so that he could get an honorable discharge, and that led him to be able to fight in Fort Lewis and start his career. The way I found that out was I was going through the U.S. Archives in St. Louis that has military records, and I was requesting Rocky's Army service file, and I had heard rumblings that he had had some disciplinary problems in the Army, but nowhere to the extent of what I discovered. And I remember asking the archivist, and she said, well, he's a prominent person, so we've digitized his military record, and we can give you that on a CD. And then she caught herself, and she said, but we also have this paper transcript of his court-martial, if you would like that. And I said, I would like that.
It was like the ka-ching moment in your mind, right?
Yes, and it was over 200 pages. It was like a police case file. It was a trial transcript, witness statements, police reports, his service records, his disciplinary records. It was a rich treasure trove of information, and it had his mugshots, which appear in the book for the first time in public history.
What was your research process in terms of relying on going back, reading media reports from the time of Marciano's career, and then also looking for some of these new sources, archives that had not been exposed to the public before? How did you organize your search for information?
Well, first of all, they like to say that journalism is the first rough draft of history. And the 1940s and 50s, there's a really rich record left of, you know, tremendous magazines, many newspapers. New York City had, two dozen newspapers. And it was really the golden age of sports writing. Great sports writers like A.J. Liebling, who got his start here in Providence, W.C. Hines, just so many of these great sports writers. It was fun to go back and read their work. And they closely followed boxing, because that's the other thing that drew me to this, not as an aficionado of boxing, but boxing really was a mirror into the American soul in the mid-1900s. It was as big as baseball. If you were the heavyweight champion of the world, everybody knew your name, and you were on a first-name basis with presidents, kings, and movie stars. So that was a rich record. The other thing, I have some friends at Sports Illustrated, and back then, the news magazines, they would go and they would do detailed reporting on a figure, and they would send back detailed reports and only use a fraction of it in what they wrote. And I was able to get archival material from life reporters who went to Brockton before Rocky fought for the title. And they interviewed all his family, his friends, his neighbors, people who are no longer alive that I was able to talk to. And so that was a rich resource, because it was contemporary. It wasn't people remembering years later.
What does the decline in popularity of boxing from the mid-20th century tell us about America and American sports?
I think another big appeal to me in writing this book was you can really look at the American immigrant experience through the boxing ring. In the early 1900s, when boxing was really illegal and something that was, put on by Tammany Hall in backroom clubs, it was the province of, you had a lot of Jewish fighters looking for assimilation, looking for a way up. Then you had the Irish fighters, then the Italians, then the blacks and Hispanics. So as they all kind of mounted the ladder, other groups came along, and it started to fade in popularity. And the other thing that really hurt it, that I talk a lot about in the book, is the mafia control of boxing. People got so cynical with the mob cartel that ran boxing when Rocky became the champion. And they fixed fights involving Jake LaMotta and Rocky Graziano that we've, you know, certainly heard about in our history. And I think the public became very disillusioned. And finally, there was a Supreme Court case, and the monopoly was broken up. And the other thing that was happening was people were seeing the injuries, much as today in professional football, people worry about concussions. I mean, one chapter I deal with is one of the most vicious fights Rocky had against Carmine Vingo, his first big fight in Madison Square Garden, where he almost killed him. And there was a lot of talk back then about, you know, what this violence was doing to boxers and the crowd's bloodlust and whether it was worth it. You know, the same kind of soul-searching and hand-wringing we see with NFL football today. So it was interesting, you know, a few years before his death, after he'd been retired, Rocky was in London doing a public appearance, and he was in his hotel suite with some hangers-on, and a London writer stopped by, and he was reminiscing about his old fights, and then he suddenly got very wistful, and he said, you know, in 10, 20, 30, 40 years, boxing's going to be gone. We're going to be the last of the gladiators. And, you know, he kind of saw that.
This is your second book. You had previously written about Buddy Cianci in The Prince of Providence. Are you planning to pursue a book project about Raymond Patriarca, the former head of organized crime in New England?
Yeah, I think I am. I'm thinking about it, Ian. And I've talked to some people about it. I've gathered a lot of material, and I would consider it my Providence trilogy. You know, the Buddy Cianci book really got me interested in Rocky Marciano because Rocky fought 29 of his 49 professional fights in Providence at the old Rhode Island Auditorium. And when I was researching Buddy's life for The Prince of Providence, I was researching what Providence was like in the 40s and 50s when boxing here was at its heyday. And Buddy's father would take him to the Monday night fights, and they would watch Rocky Marciano. And that was a very intriguing, colorful era to me. So in writing this book, I was able to dig into that even deeper. And I talked to people who were there at the auditorium, who knew the mob guys, who saw a young Raymond Patriarca, you know, in the back chomping on his cigar with, you know, hanging out with the bookies during the fights. And there was obviously a lot of rumors of fixed fights. I talk about a few of those in the book. And so Raymond Patriarca, you know, he's obviously a figure in Buddy's story. He's obviously a figure in Rocky's story, so maybe he deserves his own book.
All right, Mike Stanton, the author of Unbeaten, Rocky Marciano's Fight for Perfection in a Crooked World. Thank you for sitting down with us.
Thank you very much, Ian.